Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' basement, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we are coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, Talk Radio AM 640. Right about now, at least here in the East, churches are getting out. The resurrection service, the holiest night of the year for Christians. Christos anesti, aletos anesti. Christ is risen, indeed he has risen. Orthodox Christians will be taking lit candles home from the church. And if you're driving around, you might actually see people with candles in their cars. It's kind of a unique cultural event. They have these special lanterns so they can transport the flame from the church in their car and then to home, where they'll keep it lit for as long as they can. And these candles are lit one by one in each Orthodox church across the world. And that flame has one common source. It's called the Holy Fire. And every year, just before Pascha, Easter, this blue flame miraculously lights in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. It's a blue light, and it emanates within Christ's tomb, usually rising from the marble slab covering the stone bed, believed to be that upon which Jesus' body was placed for burial. And from this blue light, which again lights spontaneously, and supposedly, according to the story, it will not burn you if you touch it. And it spontaneously lights all of the lamps and candles around the church in the Holy Sepulchre. And then this single light is spread from candle to candle to candle to candle around the world. It's a beautiful and holy thing to behold. And my Leafs beat the Caps in overtime to tie the series 1-1. So it is indeed a night for miracles. Speaking of the Holy Fire, we hope to bring some light to bear on something I've had on the back burner for a while, but there has been so much going on in the world, and this mystery wasn't going anywhere, so I thought it could wait, but we will wait no more. Back in December 2016, a number of papers, I saw it in the New York Post, ran the following headline: Massive Anomaly Lurks Beneath Ice in Antarctica. Do you remember this story? Scientists believe a massive object that could change our understanding of history is hidden beneath the Antarctic ice. The huge and mysterious anomaly is thought to be lurking between or beneath the frozen wastes of an area called Wilkes Land. The area is 151 miles across and has a minimum depth of about 2,700 feet. Some researchers believe it is the remains of a truly massive asteroid more than twice the size of the space rock that wiped out the dinosaurs. If this explanation is true, it could mean this killer asteroid caused the Permian-Triassic extinction event, which killed 96% of Earth's sea creatures and up to 70% of the vertebrate organisms living on land. However, the New York Post article goes on, the wilder minds of the internet have come up with their own theories, with some conspiracy theorists claiming this object could be a massive UFO base or a portal to a mysterious underworld called the Hollow Earth. This Wilkes Land gravity anomaly was first uncovered in 2006 when NASA satellites spotted gravitational changes which indicated the presence of a huge object sitting in the middle of a 300-mile-wide impact crater. Now the internet has lit up with discussions of the mysterious observations after the UFO hunting crew Secure Team 10 posted a YouTube video about the anomaly. Secure Team 10 suggested the Nazis built secret bases in Antarctica during World War II, which were designed to be used by flying saucers. Those of you well-versed in UFO lore are no doubt familiar with the story of Operation High Jump, led by Rear Admiral Richard Byrd back in 1946 and 47, and that was an actual naval operation, which began in the month of August, ended in late February 47, And this task force included 4,700 men, 13 ships, and 33 aircraft. Its primary mission was to establish the Antarctic research base Little America 4. But the alternate version of Operation High Jump says that the real mission had to do with a secret Nazi base that had been established in the Antarctic dating back prior to World War II. And after the war, there were about 250,000 German soldiers, by some accounts, who were missing, unaccounted for. Instead of defeating the remnants of the Third Reich, Admiral Byrd, supposedly, and his forces met stiff resistance in the Antarctic, not only from the Nazis, but allegedly also from UFOs. So we'll attempt to unravel that story in hour one of the program when Dr. Michael Sala, a pioneer of exopolitics, joins me here on Coast to Coast. In hours two, three, and four, documentary filmmaker Ali Siadatan returns to the program to discuss the alien abduction phenomenon through the lens of biblical prophecy. Ali has recently traveled back to his native Iran. He's interviewed Dr. David Jacobs and L.A. Marzulli extensively and many others as he pieces together a rather disturbing narrative. In this alien abduction scenario, E.T. is not here to save the planet. The alien abduction phenomena is rather a fulfillment of biblical prophecy, part of the greatest deception the world has ever known. And to understand who is piloting these craft and why they're taking humans aboard, you have to understand what was going on during the biblical days of Noah and before. Ali Siadatan will be here to explain why the alien abduction and human-alien hybrid project really has nothing to do with ETs and everything to do with the Antichrist and the 10 Nephilim kings. Secret Nazi bases in the Antarctic, aided and abetted by alien technology, and the alien abduction alien-human hybrid program understood through the lens of biblical prophecy coming your way. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. You're listening to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Dr. Michael Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. He's the author of Exposing U.S. Government Policies on Extraterrestrial Life and Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence. Dr. Sala was an assistant professor researcher in residence in the School of International Service, American University, from 1996 to 2004. He has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland, Australia. He is also the founder of the Exopolitics Institute, a nonprofit organization that analyzes the political implications of extraterrestrial life. And I should also mention his other book, Kennedy's Last Stand: Eisenhower, MJ-12, UFOs, and the JFK assassination. Dr. Michael Sala, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm well, Richard. Glad to be back.
Let me get your take on this massive, mysterious object said to be below the surface of the ice in the Antarctic. And I don't know anything about this UFO group called Secure Team 10. But setting aside their views, what do you think this huge object is?
Well, I think you did cover what might be the kind of conventional scientific explanation for it in terms of an impact crater that scientists believe occurred millions of years ago that created an extinction level event, and that at the center of this impact crater is what is a magnetic anomaly that they believe is what explains how the GRACE satellite is being affected by the remains of this crater or this impact that occurred millions of years ago. So that's the scientific explanation for it. But what I think is quite possible here is that we are probably trying to understand something that might be related to some advanced technology that uses space-time technology that is going to radically affect gravitational fields around it, and that's going to be something detected by the magnetometers on instruments such as the NASA GRACE satellite.
And what of this piece of lore that you know, will not die, that the Nazis had established a UFO, had established a base down there. In fact, I believe there was an Admiral Dönitz, I think his name was Admiral Karl Dönitz, during the Nuremberg trial, made some vague reference to the fact that Hitler's not dead and he's escaped to some earthly paradise, some impregnable fortress. He didn't mention specifically. Some have pointed to that as a clue that the Nazis did establish a huge submarine naval base down in the Antarctic. What are your thoughts on that piece of lore?
Sure. Well, Admiral Karl Dönitz was in charge of Nazi Germany's Kriegsmarine, its submarine fleet, and he, in fact, boasted three times. The first time was in 1943, so this is during the war, that he actually said that the Nazis had established an impregnable fortress in a Shangri-La in an unknown region of the world. Now, he didn't say anything about where that was, but we get a clue in terms of the involvement of the Kriegsmarine, or you know, that the submarine fleet, in establishing that. Now, what has happened over the last just over the last 12 months is that a historic figure has emerged who was actually part of a Navy espionage program that was spying on what the Nazis were doing. And he says that 29 Navy spies were reporting back to the Navy's to the Naval Air Station in San Diego about the Nazis' developments in various aerospace programs, and they were reporting that the Nazis had in fact established bases in Antarctica, not just one base but two bases in Antarctica, and that these bases were being entered into through underwater caverns that basically went underneath the ice sheet of Antarctica, and that Germany's submarine fleet was able to access huge underground caverns in Antarctica where they basically built huge bases. So here we have, and this gentleman is William Tompkins, and he's still alive. He's 94, turning 95 in May. And he was part of this Navy program, and he has given his first-hand witness testimony and his involvement in this Navy espionage program, and that indeed the Navy knew about the Nazi submarine fleets being able to find these underground caverns in Antarctica, and throughout the Second World War were bringing in large numbers of people and equipment and resources to build out two large bases under the Antarctic ice shelf. And so what he has testified to is really the first time that we have a witness who was aware of what exactly the Nazis were doing during this time. So he was part of the debriefings of these Navy spies, and he has been revealing more and more details about the bases that the Nazis had built out. So he's basically confirming what Admiral Dönitz was bragging about beginning in 1943, that indeed the Nazis did build an impregnable fortress through the Kriegsmarine, and he was able to locate or identify that the location was Antarctica underneath the ice sheet.
And this base was also used, from what I understand, to house or to store much of the Nazi war plunder, gold, unimaginable wealth and art and so forth that was stolen while they plundered across Europe. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, that's right, that the Nazis throughout the war, especially once it became clear after the Normandy invasion, that Nazi Germany was headed for inevitable defeat. More and more of the Nazis' plunder was taken out of Europe to these hidden locations in South America and in Antarctica. And basically throughout the Second World War, the Nazis were sending off vast numbers of submarines down to Antarctica with massive loads of equipment, resources, plunder, scientific personnel, as well as slave labor, women to basically be part of this new Nazi regime that was being established in Antarctica after the collapse of the Third Reich, that the Nazis were already planning for the Fourth Reich, and that would be centered out of Antarctica. And so, yes, and we know that the Nazis produced thousands of submarines throughout the Second World War, and that only a percentage of these, a small percentage of these, were accounted for, which meant that the bulk of the Nazi submarines were never located. And so this kind of like supports what William Tompkins says happened in Antarctica, and what Karl Dönitz bragged about the Kriegsmarine establishing this Shangri-La in an impenetrable region of the world.
Dr. Michael Sala is with us, and he the author of Kennedy's Last Stand, Eisenhower, MJ-12, UFOs, and the JFK Assassination, the website exopolitics.org. So the war closes, and it's interesting to note that the German army surrendered, but not the Vice Chancellor, not the Third Reich, which has led some to speculate that they never really lost the war at all. They simply moved their base of operation, but I suppose that's a discussion for another time. But after the close of the war, all of a sudden we have this joint project that involves the Americans, the Brits, the Australians, and perhaps there were even some Canadians involved, Operation High Jump. Ostensibly, it's to form this or create a some sort of a scientific outpost in the Antarctic. But some theorize that, in fact, this was an attempt to attack the remnants of the Third Reich in the Antarctic.
Right. Well, there have always been rumors about Operation High Jump in terms of it being something that came to a premature end because of some new enemy that Admiral Byrd encountered. There was a newspaper report in Chile, in El Mercurio, where a reporter, Lee Atta, described a new enemy that could fly from pole to pole that Admiral Byrd encountered. And so that immediately led to people speculating that something really strange happened down there in Antarctica. Admiral Byrd published a diary that was, he wrote a diary and it was posthumously published, which is very controversial in terms of, you know, whether it really was him, but that kind of added to the rumors. There were others, other whistleblowers that came forward, talking about Nazis establishing a space program out of Antarctica. What really kind of added a lot of legitimacy to these stories were what you described earlier, the KGB files that were released in the early 1990s. Roger Moore actually put together a documentary where he talked about some of these files, the KGB files, and some of them basically revealed that Stalin was aware of Soviet penetration of the Pentagon, where the Soviet spies learned about what really happened with Operation High Jump, that there were at least two first-hand reports by naval personnel describing Navy ships and aircraft being attacked from flying saucers coming out of the water, and that these really decimated the military jets. There was an aircraft carrier that was part of Operation High Jump. And so that really strengthened the kind of rumors that, in fact, that there was an attack by flying saucers against...
All right, let's pick that up on the other side, Dr. Sala, as we'll continue to delve into this massive anomaly buried deep beneath the Antarctica. Dr. Michael Sala, my guest here on Coast to Coast. Here are the Kinks, taking us into the break with Picture Book. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. That's Tom Jones and Didn't It Rain from Long Lost Suitcase, which is, in my estimation, perhaps his best album ever. And that's saying a lot. A BBC News is reporting that North Korea attempted to launch a missile Sunday near Sinpo on its east coast, but it's believed to have failed. That's a big fail, according to South Korea's military. The attempted missile launch comes a day after the North had a military parade in its capital marking the birth anniversary of the state founder, where what appeared to be new ballistic missiles were displayed. Incidentally, when we hear that one of North Korea's missiles failed to launch, that's no accident, folks. This is cyber warfare and American subterfuge at its best. Poor Kim Jong-un. He forgot to update his antivirus software. Boo-hoo-hoo. ParanormalDate.com. Get this. Now approaching 62,000 members. It's completely free to join and search, and you can use the code GEORGE for a sizable discount if you want to get further involved. And the service is also available on free iOS and Android apps. Check out the new companion site as well, ConspiracyDate.com, ParanormalDate.com. Remember, you are not alone. When we come back, more of my conversation with Dr. Michael Sala as we continue to discuss this anomalous, massive thing underneath the Antarctic ice, and whether it relates to secret Nazi UFO bases and Operation High Jump. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Just a reminder, coming up at the top of the hour, documentary filmmaker Ali Siadatan will talk about his new project, Goliath Rising, Hybrids, Nephilim, and Titans. Right now, Dr. Michael Sala stays with us, a pioneer in the development of exopolitics. The website, exopolitics.org, and his latest, Kennedy's Last Stand, Eisenhower, MJ-12, UFOs, and the JFK assassination. We're talking about this massive anomaly beneath the ice in the Antarctic, 151 miles wide. And if memory serves, there were reports that then Secretary of State John Kerry made kind of what seemed at the time an impromptu visit down the to the Antarctic. What do you know about that? Do you think there's any connection?
I believe there is a connection there. What happened was Kerry went to the main U.S. base, the main base there in Antarctica, the U.S. base, just by the Ross Ice Shelf, and then he traveled to the South Pole. And what's interesting is that the South Pole has a hole in it going into some, going down around 2 miles. And this was something that has been commented on by a Navy engineer that gave his testimony to Linda Moulton Howe, and she covered it on Coast a couple of years ago. And essentially what he was told was that he was in a flight flying over this hole by the South Pole, but to kind of like not go near it. But they did fly over it, and they saw quite clearly that it was a hole going quite down, deep down into Antarctica. So they had drilled down into Antarctica, or it was a hole that was produced through geothermal energy coming from the Antarctic continent itself, because it's seismically very active. Now, I'm also working with a whistleblower by the name of Corey Good, and he says that in January of this year, that he was taken down to Antarctica by a group of inner Earth beings, and he actually went to that hole that was seen by this Navy engineer at the top of the South Pole. So Corey Good, that he said that he went down to the bottom of that, and that at the bottom of that was a very large cavern, and that they were excavating the remains of a extraterrestrial civilization down there, and that he saw some of the bodies, he saw some of the artifacts, the technologies that were built by this extraterrestrial civilization, and that he was also aware of three motherships that were buried under the ice shelf, and that they were miles long, and that in these motherships that there were beings that were in stasis chambers. And that's very significant to the discussion we were having about the Wilkes Land magnetic anomaly, because these stasis chambers are creating a time dilation effect, which would actually, if it were being observed from space, would register as a massive magnetic anomaly. So here you have a possible explanation for the magnetic anomalies that have been observed in Antarctica, whether it's the Wilkes Land anomaly, whether we're talking about the Lake Vostok anomaly, or other anomalies that are being registered by these satellites.
So if the Nazis had a base down there, they didn't do it all on their own. Ostensibly, they had some assistance from extraterrestrial race? Are we talking about perhaps the reptilians? Who do you think was involved in building that underground base?
Well, you know, this is one of the amazing things that emerges out of William Tompkins' testimony. And I have to just kind of add here, Richard, like my latest book is called The U.S. Navy's Secret Space Program and Nordic Extraterrestrial Alliance, and that was just released last month. And in that book, I examine William Tompkins' testimony and basically provide a lot of documents to substantiate that he actually was part of this Navy espionage program out of Antarctica, and that he got a lot of firsthand information about what the Nazis were doing down there. And he actually did say that one of the things that the Navy spies reported on was that the Nazis were being helped by a group of reptilian extraterrestrials. So this was known by the Navy back during the Second World War. So, you know, this takes it beyond the realm of conspiracy theory, which, you know, I think a lot of people dismiss this kind of information as really just conjecture by people without any substantive documentation. Well, you know, I actually have provided the documentation in this book that this Navy espionage program did exist, that William Tompkins was a part of this, that it was run by a Rear Admiral, Rickel Boulder, and that he was working directly under orders of the Navy Secretary, Forrestal. James Forrestal. And so, you know, there's documentation showing that this really did happen. So this is not just conspiracy theory. Here you have an official Navy espionage program where the Navy learned firsthand from these 29 Navy spies that Nazi Germany had indeed reached agreements with this reptilian extraterrestrial race, and that the reptilians were assisting the Nazis in developing advanced aerospace programs, including flying saucers.
Dr. Sala, the origin of the Foo Fighter?
This was related to that the Nazis were working on 30 different prototypes, different types of flying saucer craft, and that they were trying to weaponize these for the war effort. And fortunately for the Allies, the Nazis were unsuccessful in weaponizing the flying saucers in occupied Europe. But what wasn't well known was how far advanced the Nazi flying saucer program became in Antarctica. And it was only during Operation High Jump which was really nearly 2 years after the Nazis lost the war in Europe, that Operation High Jump reached Antarctica, and the Nazis had almost an additional 2 years to weaponize these, and they had indeed succeeded in weaponizing their flying saucers. And so rather than trying to weaponize them with projectile weapons, which were, which is what happened in occupied Europe by the Nazi SS, they tried to put cannons on these flying saucers, and they simply weren't successful because these were incompatible physics. You're trying to combine, projectile mechanics, Newton's laws of motions, with torsion field physics, and it just didn't work. But the Nazis in Antarctica succeeded in developing directed energy weapons, and this is compatible with torsion field physics, which is what made the Nazi flying saucer program successful in Antarctica.
One would have to wonder how then the Nazis managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory if they were teamed up with reptilians who were, by all accounts, sort of super soldiers of the universe.
You know, it was a close thing. I mean, the Nazis got very, very close. That there are reports that the Nazis towards the end of the I think it was sometime in April of 1945, were able to deploy a flying saucer that had some kind of weapons or some sort of a cannon technology applied to it, and that this was successful to a certain degree. But by that time, the bomber fleets, they were flying 1,000 bombers a night over occupied Europe and over Nazi Germany. So, the Nazis with their super weapon programs, they simply ran out of time. But the thing is that by the time the Allied powers were able to project their military forces into Antarctica, the Nazis down there had an additional 2 years to prepare. And by then, they were ready. And as we know from the Operation High Jump reports and what the Soviets released, or the KGB released, that the Nazis succeeded in being able to weaponize their technologies.
What about Nazi participation in alien abductions? I'm trying to remember whether or not in the Betty and Barney Hill case there was made mention of either Betty or Barney seeing someone who appeared to be a German officer aboard one of these craft.
Absolutely correct, yes. In fact, both abductions and contact events, both of these have elements of the Nazi presence, because the Nazis were working with the reptilian extraterrestrials, and that grey extraterrestrials were part of that alliance. And as you said, yes, Barney Hill, in one of his initial descriptions of his abductors, did describe people that looked very much like Nazi SS officers on these flying saucers. Also, another one of, this comes from Corey Good, and his accounts of his service on a secret space program. He said that he learned about the case involving Billy Meyer, where he says that Billy Meyer was approached by people from the intelligence community, most likely the CIA or maybe naval intelligence. And they approached him and they showed him a picture of Maria Orsic, who was involved in the Nazi space program out of both Germany, both pre-World War II, and during the Antarctica period, and that Billy Meyer looked at the photo and said, "That's her, that's her, that's Semyase." This was the Pleiadian that he was having contact experiences. So, that is another element showing that the Nazis were involved not only in the abduction phenomenon, but also in the contactee phenomenon that occurred later in the 1970s, at least with the Billy Meyer case.
After Operation High Jump, were there other attempts by Allied forces to attack this Nazi base in the Antarctic?
Well, what happened, this comes from both the secret space program people I've been working with and other sources. What essentially happened was that Operation High Jump was basically where the Nazis were able to demonstrate that they were just decades ahead of anything the US had in terms of advanced aerospace programs. That the U.S. didn't have anything approaching what the Nazis had been able to achieve in terms of weaponizing flying saucers. And then in 1952, during those flying saucer waves over Washington, D.C., in July of 52, that these, in fact, were Nazi flying saucers. And, you know, just contemplate that, Richard, and the audience as well. You know, if that is true, what message would that have sent to the Truman administration and then to the Eisenhower administration? That Andrews Air Force Base nearby, the jet fighters, that they weren't even ordered to intercept these flying saucers because the Nazis had demonstrated quite clearly that anything that tried to intercept or tried to engage with these flying saucers, that they would be taken down. So, you know, here you have Nazi flying saucers flying over Washington, D.C. So the Nazis, and I think that this is one of the major contributions that Corey Good, William Tompkins, Clark McClelland, and others have been able to contribute to our understanding of the flying saucer phenomenon, that 1952 Washington flyover, that these were not just extraterrestrial craft as is widely assumed, that this involved Nazi flying saucers.
Right. I mean, how do you sell that to the American public, that we are still under attack by an enemy that we supposedly vanquished 7 years earlier? It also sort of ties in perhaps to Roswell. And there is, of course, that theory that the reason the Army initially came out with the story that it was a captured flying disc, better an alien disc than to say that the Nazis are entering U.S. airspace 2 years after the war entered.
Well, exactly right. I think this is one of the things of that would explain why it was that the flying saucer phenomenon kind of had this secrecy imposed all over it. Because, as you said, you know, it wasn't just a matter of extraterrestrial life. I mean, the extraterrestrial element was certainly there. But that the Nazis were involved in this was something that was tremendously embarrassing, not only to the Truman administration, but also to the Soviet Union, to Stalin and Khrushchev and other Soviet leaders after the fact, because none of them wanted to reveal to the general public that the Nazis had survived the war, that the war, in fact, was lost, that the battle, even though they won the battle for Europe, that they lost the war for dominance of planet Earth, and that the Nazis in Antarctica had established a dominance over the planet through their alliance with the reptilians. And so what happened was that after the Washington flyover in 1952 and the Nazis demonstrated that they could fly over the most secure airspace in the United States, basically there was a negotiated surrender, and that took the form of negotiations where the U.S. Under the Truman and then the Eisenhower administrations agreed to the terms dictated by the Nazis in Antarctica. And so basically the U.S. military industrial complex began cooperating with the Nazis, began sending down massive amounts of resources, equipment and personnel to try to assist the Nazis down there, and in the return, the Nazis promised to help the U.S. military catch up, to kind of like bridge the technological gap. And so this is really what occurred, and history will show that the Nazis basically succeeded in being able to dominate the U.S. Military-industrial complex throughout the 50s and 60s, and it was only in the latter part of the 90s and the early 2000s that the U.S. military began to gain a certain degree of independence, and that was where the U.S. Navy began to break from the military-industrial complex, which really became part of the Nazi Fourth Reich.
Well, and this perhaps is the ultimate dirty little secret at the root of the truth embargo over the ET UFO issue. It's not about free energy. It's not about religion. It's about the fact that the Nazis won the war and the Fourth Reich is still in charge. A conversation perhaps we'll have to leave. Well, we will have to leave till another time. Dr. Sala, thank you so much. I enjoyed this conversation immensely.
Thank you for having me, Richard. Aloha.
The website, exopolitics.org. Ali Siadatan, Goliath Rising, up next. Here are the Proclaimers. I'm on my way, taking us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM.